Remembrances, Exor Memoria by Jejusor, read by CookieMom6067. The first time Clint gets assassinated by the Winter Soldier, he doesn't see it coming, which is quite a testament to the guy's skills. Clint dies all the time, but usually he's aware that it's happening. It's been decades since anyone caught him off guard like this. "Coward," he yells down the dark alley he was ambushed from, as soon as his larynx is healed enough to function. "Get back here and murder me to my face." There's no answer. Clint scowls and rubs along the line of still raw skin marking where his throat was just slit. The guy really knew what he was doing, which means Clint should be able to figure out who he is, or at least whose payroll he's on. Most of the people who come after him don't do work this clean. It's got to be either the Nazis or the mob. He doesn't figure out who it was, not then. It's 1949. The Soviets just started testing nuclear weapons, and Clint is too much of a smartass to make it through any anti-communist interrogation unscathed. He can't die, but he can get locked up, and he ends up spending several significant chunks of the 50s bored out of his mind in various prison cells. By the time the launch of Sputnik distracts the U.S. government from prosecuting Clint for his stupid Robin Hood jokes, he's written off the throat-slitting incident as a one-time thing. It is very much not a one-time thing. "You shouldn't be alive," says the soldier, his M3 trained unwaveringly on Clint's heart. "Ain't that the truth?" Clint agrees. They're on a rooftop of a hotel in L.A., probably both there to crash the same party in the penthouse suite. It's 1964, just a few months after the Kennedy assassination, and Clint is almost positive he's looking at the guy who did it. He's heard the rumors, the metal arm, the superhuman strength, the eerie stillness. He doesn't know who the guy works for, but the big red star on his shoulder is looking like a little bit of a clue. "You're dead," says the soldier. From what Clint can see of his face above the mask, he looks like he's not accustomed to being confused. "Clint Barton, my intel says I killed you over 14 years ago." Clint, on the other hand, is perfectly comfortable with confusion. "Why the hell would you need intel if you're the one who did it?" The soldier stares at him blankly for a few more seconds before shooting him in the chest. A lot, according to the state of his torso, when he recovers. The soldier is gone. "Man," Clint mutters, poking at the bloody mess of fabric clinging to his chest. "I liked this shirt." 7 years later, they run into each other on a beach, just outside Bangkok. The soldier shoots Clint in the head without the chit-chat this time, but when Clint sits up, he's still there, cross-legged in the sand, 10 feet away, with his gun in his lap. "Why didn't you die?" he asks. He sounds genuinely curious, not frustrated or angry. "I did," Clint says. "That's the third time you've killed me. Should I bother cleaning up, or are you just going to do it again?" The soldier's eyebrows draw together slightly. "My orders were to kill you. I killed you." "Congratulations." Clint pulls a handkerchief out of his knapsack and starts mopping himself up, scooting away from the patch of wet red sand behind him. "Do you have any water? Losing that much blood makes a body thirsty." The soldier just stares at him. Clint's not optimistic about his chances of extracting any useful information here, but he's got to give it a shot. "Who are you working for? Why are you targeting me?" "Standing orders," the soldier says. "Anyone on the list is to be killed on sight unless it compromises a higher priority mission." "Who's giving these orders? Where'd you get the list?" Another blank stare. Clint sighs. "Well, if you're satisfied that you've followed your orders, I guess I'll be going then." The soldier doesn't try to stop him, just trails his departure with those creepy, pretty eyes. 1974, Washington, D.C. The soldier shoots Clint in the middle of the street and keeps walking. 1977, London. The soldier stabs Clint in the gut at a Sex Pistols concert. 1979, Tehran. The soldier strangles Clint with his bare hands in the middle of a riot, grimly maintaining eye contact until Clint's vision goes black. 1983, the vestibule of a rest stop bathroom somewhere in Ohio, 3 a.m. The soldier shoots Clint in the head again, and he's still there when Clint recovers. "Why didn't you die?" he asks. "Dude," says Clint, "we've been over this. I don't stay dead." The soldier stares. "You remember me, right, Clint Barton? You've killed me like 7 times. Every time you see me because I'm on the list." "How do you know about the list?" the soldier asks. Clint feels weirdly hurt. He kind of thought they had a thing going here. "You told me on the beach in Thailand back in 71. You don't remember?" The soldier casually punches through the front of a vending machine with his metal hand and pulls out a water bottle, offering it to Clint. "You lost blood," he says. "You do remember." Clint accepts the water, delighted. The soldier shakes his head. "I don't remember. I just know losing that much blood makes a body thirsty." "Huh." Clint takes a swallow from the bottle and glances around. "We probably don't want to be sitting here if anyone comes in, giant puddle of blood and all." The soldier gracefully rises to his feet and strides out the door. Clint takes another long drink from the bottle and follows. By the time he steps outside, the soldier is gone. In 1986, they run into each other at a charity banquet in Manhattan, and Clint yelps, "Not the tux, not the tux." "Excuse me?" asks the soldier, eyebrows raised high. For half a second, Clint considers the possibility that it's not actually the soldier, but no, he'd know those eyes anywhere. Unless it compromises a higher priority mission, he remembers. The soldier must be here undercover. It's the first time he's seen the man without the black mask covering his mouth and nose. He's astonishingly beautiful. "Sorry, thought you were someone else," Clint says. "Clint Barton, nice to meet you. I was just about to go get some air on the terrace. Care to join me?" "I was just about to go hide in my hotel room until the dinner starts," the soldier smiles. "Care to join me?" He suffocates Clint with a pillow, straddling him on the bed. It's the hottest fucking thing that's happened to Clint in his extraordinarily long life. "Why didn't you die?" the soldier asks. He rolls his hips against Clint's aching erection, hands planted on the bed, either side of Clint's shoulders, hair hanging in his face. "I did," Clint says, reaching up to grab him by the bow tie and yank him down into a kiss. "And the tux doesn't make it through the night unscathed after all." "Why didn't you die?" the soldier asks, after he drowns Clint in the holy loch off the coast of Scotland, and Clint says, "I did," and kisses him. "Why didn't you die?" the soldier asks, after he strangles Clint in a public garden in Kyoto, and Clint says, "I did," and kisses him. "Why didn't you die?" the soldier asks, after he poisons Clint's drink in a dive bar in Chicago, and Clint says, "I did," and tries to kiss him. Except the soldier thinks he's just trying to poison him back, so that one doesn't go over quite as well. In 1999, the soldier shoots Clint's face off in the desert in Morocco, then offers him a water bottle. "Losing that much blood makes a body thirsty," he says. Clint eyes him thoughtfully. "Losing that much blood makes his body die," he points out between gulps of water. "But for people who don't stay dead, losing that much blood causes thirst," says the soldier. Clint frowns. "How many people have you met who don't stay dead?" "I don't know," says the soldier. "I don't remember things. They don't let me remember." "Huh," says Clint. "Hey, fun fact. People who don't stay dead like pizza, did you know that?" The soldier shakes his head. "Now you do," Clint says, and takes another gulp. "Why didn't you die?" the soldier asks after he runs Clint off the road into a tree and then shoots him, even though he already died once when he hit the tree. "Sheesh." "I did," says Clint. "I don't stay dead. What do you know about people who don't stay dead?" "They get thirsty when they lose a lot of blood," says the soldier. "And they like pizza." Clint can feel the grin spreading across his face. "Why didn't you die?" the soldier asks in Cairns 4 years later. I don't stay dead, Clint tells him. The soldier holsters his gun and kisses him. He doesn't know Clint, but he knows that people who don't stay dead have a sensitive spot on their neck just under their ear where they love to be teased. People who don't stay dead sleep light and sometimes wake up in a panic, not knowing where they are and need to be soothed back to sleep with strong arms and soft whispers. People who don't stay dead need caffeine in the morning. And when you sneak out early to pick up coffee and bring it back just as they're waking up, they smile and kiss you and thank you like it means something, like you matter to each other. The soldier doesn't know Clint, but he knows the shape of who they are to each other, coiled tightly around the empty space where knowing Clint should go. It's something to do with semantic memory, according to a friendly reference librarian who thought Clint was researching dementia. The soldier loses his episodic memory, so he can't remember anything that's happened between the two of them before, but he retains information, as long as it's framed as general knowledge. He remembers facts, and Clint can work with that. The soldier fucks Clint hard and slow, the way people who don't stay dead like it best, and pulls him in close when they're done. Clint rests his head on the soldier's shoulder, throwing one leg over both of the soldiers. "I like that," the soldier says. He always sounds surprised about enjoying things. "I know," Clint murmurs. "How do you know?" asks the soldier. Clint considers how to frame it. "Because you have a metal arm," he decides. "People who have one metal arm like to cuddle like this with a leg on top of them." The soldier is quiet for a moment. Then he asks, "What else do you know about people who have one metal arm?" In 2012, on a stolen yacht in the Mediterranean Sea, the soldier shoots Clint in the chest. Clint sits back up and the soldier drops to his knees and kisses him. "How long do we have until extraction?" Clint asks, resting their foreheads together. "About 6 hours," the soldier says. "I tried to disable the tracker, but they updated it." The soldier's handlers are mystified as to how he knows about the tracker in his metal arm. They've tried to interrogate him, but he can't tell them where he learned about it, because he doesn't remember learning about it. He just knows that people with one metal arm have trackers embedded. He knows the schematics of the last one and how to turn it off. He knows that they don't want him to know. He doesn't know who his handlers are because Clint has never been able to find out. All he knows about himself is what Clint has been able to teach him. People with one metal arm like to be cuddled with a leg on top of them. People with one metal arm don't remember most of the things that have happened to them because the memories have been taken away. They can't disobey directives from their handlers, but they can willfully misinterpret orders that are vague enough. Their favorite food so far is hot dogs, but they want to keep trying new things to find out what else is good. The soldier knows that people who don't stay dead love people with one metal arm. He knows that people who don't stay dead want to help people with one metal arm, want to figure out who's controlling them and get them away, take them somewhere safe. He knows that no matter how many times they try and fail, people who don't stay dead will always try again. 6 hours, says Clint. We should crack open the arm and get a look at the new tracker. The soldier knows that all people, including people with one metal arm, are allowed to want things and to ask for things and to not want things and to say no. The handlers don't act like those things are true, but they are. "Kiss first?" he asks, and leans in without waiting for an answer. People who don't stay dead are also allowed to say no, but they hardly ever do. In 2014, the soldier drags an unsettlingly familiar man out of the Potomac and makes his way to the extraction point. No one comes to meet him. He has standing orders for this contingency, but they've never been necessary and no one has thought to update them since he started trying to game the rules. It's easy to interpret "go back to the base" as "go to any base you've previously visited," and to choose a base he knows is defunct. And once he's done that, He has no more orders to follow. He disables the tracker in his arm and the one in his tack vest, lifts a cell phone off a teenager at a bus stop, and calls a number he doesn't remember learning. "There's one phone number for all the people who don't stay dead?" the soldier asked back in 2008. "Yeah, it's a... okay. You know what 911 is, right?" "Yes, it's an abort signal. If I see anyone dial those numbers, I have to leave the scene within 2 minutes. "Hmm. Well, let's just call this an informational hotline for people who don't stay dead. See if that sticks." "Hello, who is this?" asks a distracted voice. There are faint sounds of explosions in the background. "I'm not sure," says the soldier. The voice catches on a breath. "Where are you? How long do we have until extraction?" "I'm in Norfolk, Virginia," says the soldier. "Extraction was 4 hours and 17 minutes ago. My handlers weren't there. I think..." He pauses, going through his active protocols again, not quite able to believe it. "I think I don't have to go back." Bucky Barnes shoots Clint in the chest, and Clint is smiling as he dies and smiling as he opens his eyes again. Bucky is already on his knees, helping Clint sit up, kissing him, clutching the back of his neck. "You remembered, Steve," Clint says into the kiss. "You got away from the bastards. We have a chance now, a real fucking chance. God, I've missed you, sweetheart." Bucky loves being called sweetheart. Clint has never bothered to teach him that as a fact. He likes the little flash of delighted surprise every time Bucky hears it for the first time. Bucky lets out a shaky breath and says, "I think I've missed you too." Clint pulls back to stare at him. "What?" "I think..." Bucky's metal thumb strokes the back of Clint's neck. "I think I know you." "No, I do know you. I've killed you a whole bunch of times." Clint nods, his heart hammering in his chest. "And I remember we..." Bucky's voice trails off. "You were all dressed up the first time, weren't you? We were on a bed and I suffocated you with a pillow and then you kissed me." "The Plaza Hotel," Clint confirms, 1986. The years sometimes start blending into one another after all this time, but that one will always stand out to him. "I didn't have a protocol for you." Bucky's expression is one Clint hasn't seen on him before, eyes unfocused, lost in the past. "I had contingencies for a lot of situations, but they never told me what to do if an eliminated target came back to life. Every time you didn't stay dead, I got to make my own decision about what to do next." Clint strokes his fingers through Bucky's hair, feeling almost unbearably tender. "You should always get to make your own decisions about what to do next. Always." Bucky's eyes refocus on Clint. "I know," he says. "You helped me remember that. You figured out how it worked and helped me remember." Clint shrugs. "I tried. Not everything stuck, but I did my best to make sure you knew the important things." "You love me," Bucky says. "You helped me remember that." "Yeah," says Clint. "That's one of the important things." Bucky frowns. "You didn't help me remember that I love you too." "Well, that would have been a pretty fucking shitty idea to program into somebody's brain, wouldn't it?" Clint shakes his head. "That's not something anyone can tell you, babe. You got to get there on your own." "I'm there," Bucky says, without a breath's pause. "I love you. If I ever forget again, I want you to help me remember that. Got it?" Clint closes his eyes because the way Bucky is looking at him is too much to face right now. "Yeah, okay," he whispers. "I got it." He kisses Bucky again, then squeezes his shoulders. "Come on, sweetheart. Let me take you home." "I'm not complaining, okay? It's nice. I don't know why he likes me, but he obviously does, and that's great. Better than being on that motherfucker's bad side, for sure. I'm just curious because it's a little fucking bizarre." Deadpool spreads his hands wide in utter bafflement. "Why the fuck is he always bringing me pizza?" The end.